Chapter 5. I Do Now. King Chemical purchased the new labeling machine that Bernie had asked for and set it up in the room where workers had previously been making the labels by hand. The new equipment was modern. Made of stainless steel, it came with a computer touchscreen and had many dials and buttons. While it looked like it might be precise, the machine required constant fiddling, and by the time its operator realized that an adjustment was needed, a large number of rejects were produced, and quite often bottles came out of the machine crooked, off-center, or badly creased. When a label went bad, the factory had to remove it from the bottle, which was otherwise still usable. The process of removing labels required rags and solvent and was time-consuming. Because of this shiny, brand-new piece of equipment, entire work teams had to be created to fix badly labeled bottles. Sister complained often and loudly about the new machine, saying that it did nothing but increase costs for the factory. Communication issues were a source of some early quality problems. One of the very first mess-ups had to do with new labels. Johnson Carter made a lightly scented liquid soap branded Pinky Fresh. The label was supposed to have been copied directly from a file sent over from New York. For technical reasons, the factory's art department had gone to the trouble of recreating the label, and when the labels were printed, they read Prinky instead of Pinky. For the first few months, I was at the factory nearly every day, trying to get things set up. Speaking with plant managers in Chinese, we would sometimes talk about the body wash or the bubble bath, but after some time I realized that the workers on the line did not know these descriptions. "Where has the bubble bath gone?" I asked a worker one morning. My question elicited only a blank stare. It took my repeating the question for the worker to admit that he didn't know what I meant by bubble bath. Hoping to trigger an association, I mentioned it was the one that smelled like chewing gum. He laughed at me. "We don't make chewing gum," he said. "We make daily chemicals." Sister and I spoke about the exchange. She suggested that I reference the code number. Every Johnson Carter product had a 5-digit number associated with it. These numbers were printed on the production sheets, and they were also on the sides of the cartons. "Do you know where I can find 23515? I asked a warehouse worker. Without missing a beat, he pointed to the pallet stack. I tried another one. "What about 23528? He pointed in another direction, again, without hesitation. He knew precisely where every pallet was in the warehouse, but like other workers in the factory, he had no idea what it was we were making. It was impossible to ask any of the workers how the shampoo was coming along, or the conditioner, or the body wash. They didn't think about the products that we made in those terms. One reason they didn't know these words was that they never ran across these products in their daily lives. Many of the workers at the factory barely had a primary school education. Most came from hundreds or thousands of miles away, from rural corners of the country where their entire families earned a fraction of what they did in manufacturing. Before they came to work at the factory, they did not know what something like hair gel was. Most had not grown up using things like shampoo. Some of the challenges we faced in the manufacturing sector had to do with this gap in life experience. This point was made clear in local restaurants, where waiters were also brought in from the countryside. Workers had a hard time learning their jobs or understanding things that seemed fundamental to a restaurant experience, in part because they themselves had never been waited on, ever. King Chemical had workers who were unfamiliar with liquid soap. The kind that we made was a dollar store item, one that you would find in discount stores across the United States. Even if it was a low-end product, consumers expected it to function properly. Chinese workers, who saw such a thing as nearly a luxury, could not see the big deal with a faulty pump. When pumps began to fail, they were inclined to think, "So what? You can still unscrew the cap and get to the soap that way." It was easy to forget that China was still a developing economy. This painful fact was made clear even in the big cities like Guangzhou. In office buildings there, you had visitors who did not understand how elevators worked. Wanting to travel up, they would push the down button because they saw that the car was on an upper floor and they wanted the car to come down to them. And then there were the impatient ones who pressed both the up and down buttons, figuring that this would double their chances of catching an elevator car. On the mornings when I traveled from my hotel in Shantou to the factory, I caught my own ride. But as there was no taxi service in the countryside, the factory typically provided transportation for the return trip. "There, you see?" The driver pointed to a pair of middle-aged women who were attempting to cross the street. He shook a finger in their direction and jokingly said that they did not have the sense to get to a crosswalk. Tamana suja tai dila. The education level of the people is too low, he said, placing emphasis on the word tai, as if to suggest that a certain amount of ignorance was presumed, but that folks in these parts really pushed the limits of tolerability. He had been a driver in the military, he told me, and he took special pride in his driving ability. The other drivers on the road were not professionally trained, he pointed out. They were mere civilians, and the ones who did not drive at all were the real scourges of society. The factory driver was a thin, amiable fellow, and he knew that I enjoyed his little commentaries on life around Shanto. One afternoon he wagged his finger at a boy who was jaywalking. Traffic was busy and the boy had jumped out in front of a truck and startled the truck's driver into jamming on the brakes. With cars whizzing past him, the boy stood between opposing directions of traffic, the cars but a few inches away. "Jongorembo pasa," he said. It was a terrible thing to say, but I heard the same phrase repeated many times by taxi drivers in South China. Chinese are not afraid to die, they would say, shaking their heads, or sometimes chuckling as they said it. It seemed less a question of fear to me and more an issue with coordination. Standing at a small drink stand near one factory, I watched one morning as a bicyclist made his way toward the factory that I was visiting. From the opposite direction, another bicyclist was heading down the same lane. As there was no one else around, they both rode freely down the middle of the quiet road. The bicyclist who was heading toward the factory had been riding slightly left of center, and he had the idea that he probably should pass on the right. He started to move over, but then changed his mind. I watched as the two bikes wobbled back and forth in indecision, and at the very moment when they should have been passing one another, they still had not sorted themselves out. It happened almost in slow motion. Even with no obstacles on the road, they, clunk, improbably collided. It would have been amusing had it not been so sad. At the factory, we suffered from a similar kind of challenge. Where some problem might have been identified and quickly knocked out, workers did not choose to coordinate with one another, unless someone came along and gave a specific set of instructions for even the smallest task, nothing got done. When it came to products made for foreign companies, workers didn't like to make too many assumptions. Maybe they felt that they did not have enough of their own life experiences to make judgments themselves. They worried about revealing their poor education levels. Afraid to look stupid, they inevitably did things that made them appear comically so. While living in South China, you would hear stories about quality gaffes from other importers. One story that went around involved a Turkish importer who had placed an order for shoes with one Chinese manufacturer. When the shoes arrived at their destination in Turkey, a nail was found driven in the bottom of each left shoe. The head of the nail stuck out of the sole about an inch. The importer had given the factory an original sample pair and had said that he wanted the shoes made exactly like this. The only problem was that there had been a nail in the bottom of the shoe from which it had hung on a display rack. The workers at the factory did not think it prudent to ask anyone about the nail. They figured that must be how they like their shoes in Turkey, with a nail driven into the bottom of the left one, and so they filled the order just like that. One of my primary objectives during the first few months with the shampoo factory was to get the place cleaned up. Prior to my involvement, Johnson Carter received a large shipment from a previous supplier that was contaminated with bacteria. Hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of product had to be thrown away. Sister and I met to discuss hygiene. One concern was water contamination. The water that went into our soap and shampoo was coming in from county water lines, and China was notorious for its water pollution problem. The factory was located just a few thousand feet from waterways that were solid black with waste oil and other contaminants. Sister assured me that there would be no problem in this area. Their on-site water purification system would ensure the water was bacteria-free. With microbiology on my mind, I spotted one of the workers making his way across the floor. He was carrying plastic bottles, six of them, three on each hand, by placing a finger into each empty bottle. I explained to Sister how this could be a problem. She told me that she understood and would address the situation. "I will tell the workers not to put their fingers in the bottles when you are at the factory," she said. "When I am at the factory, it has nothing to do with when I am at the factory." Sister did not take the problem of fingers and bottles seriously in any case, though she indicated an understanding of science and germs. The factory's bottles were all sterilized before they went into production, and the plant even had ultraviolet lights placed around the factory, in the filling station area, and in the packaging room, in an effort to reduce environmental bacteria. The ultraviolet lights were really just for show, I eventually realized, just as the white coats and hats were. The plant managers never bothered to wear the white coats and hats, and after my initial visit to the factory, I was never asked to wear the outfit again either. Bernie was disturbed by the finger and bottle exchange when I told him about it. "I hope they are washing their hands at least," he said. Since the bathrooms had no soap, I told him that it was not likely. "They should be washing their hands all the time," he said, becoming upset. "Tell them especially when they are coming out of the bathroom." Hearing this view, it was now Sister's turn to become upset. All those workers washing up so many times was going to mean supplying a great deal of surfactant. "And just where is all of this soap going to come from?" she asked. "I don't know," I said, "but we do work in a soap factory." "That's what I thought. You want us to pay for it." "Johnson Carter would pay for the soap," I suggested, and then I took a case of our product from the warehouse and placed the bottles near every sink in the plant. The entire box of liquid soap cost Johnson Carter less than $10, but it didn't matter anyway. 2 weeks after I put the soap out, fill levels of the bottles remained unchanged. No one was using it. A few weeks after the initial discussions on hygiene, I saw one of the plant managers spitting on the factory floor. This sort of thing was not uncommon in the streets of South China, and it was only because we talked continually about keeping the factory clean that it came as a shock. Sister was belligerent on this one. "You can't expect me to force workers to behave a certain way," she said. She was defensive about her workers, more protective of them than she was worried about any other impact on the business. Anyway, she pointed out, spitting in the factory was not as bad when it was going on in the packaging room. At least, she said, it was not happening in the more sensitive filling station area. While this was true, we had serious hygiene issues in the filling station also. Johnson Carter's hand lotion was too thick to transfer with the vacuum pump system, and so workers transferred it with a large plastic scoop. When the workers moved product from a big plastic bucket to the machine that filled the bottles, they invariably made a mess of themselves in the process. I watched as one worker transferred formulation. His upper torso disappeared into the large tub, and he came up with lotion smeared across his face. If the lotion was touching his face, then germs from his face were coming in contact with the product. I took pictures for Bernie, who responded by merely saying that he wanted me to take care of it. It sounded like an easy problem to knock out, but the factory resisted any instruction in this area. The hair gel that we produced at the factory was green. One day I noticed that the worker who filled the gel bottles had a skin condition. His hands were covered with the slick formula, and beneath the green shimmery layer, I could see that the skin on his hands was peeling. Small raw patches of flesh were exposed, and you didn't have to be a dermatologist to see that his skin was infected. "We should probably do something about this one," I said to Sister, trying to sound calm, while in my head alarm bells were ringing. Sister did not see the point. "Why?" she asked. "It might be a health issue." "But the worker has done nothing wrong. It's just an allergic reaction." Trying to press the matter, I suggested that the worker might contaminate the product. Sister twisted around the argument. How can he harm the product when it was the product that caused him harm? She was entirely serious on the point, and she added to her argument that since the worker had been harmed, he should be rewarded by being kept at his post. Removing him from the filling station might be perceived as punishment, or it might be translated into face loss. As she had already established, the worker had done nothing intentional to harm anyone. It was better, in other words, that we keep his infected hands at the filling station. Never mind the business or the consumer, this was, as she saw it, the right thing to do. The issue of consumer product safety did nothing to sway, nor did worker safety, so I tried to emphasize how this might affect a shared business interest. Making a product that didn't suffer from quality failure made good economic sense, I suggested. After all, if anyone ever found out that the factory operated under such unsanitary conditions, it would be a public relations nightmare. She did not like the way this sounded, and she now raised an eyebrow at me. "How is anyone going to find out?" she asked. She was considering me carefully, trying to determine if I was making some kind of veiled threat. The only people who knew about the workers' peeling hands were workers at the factory, management, and myself. Surely no one at the factory was ever going to say anything to anyone. In the history of Chinese manufacturing, had any worker ever filed such a report? Whatever could I possibly be implying? It was frustrating to see the factory not interested in improving quality for its own sake. The only thing to do was to suggest an immediate loss of business. Bernie would be concerned, I said. Johnson Carter was responsible for transferring millions of dollars to China. What the head of that company thought carried weight. Sister said that she would consider doing something about the worker whose hands were peeling, but only if Bernie had been told and insisted that the issue needed to be addressed. Sister's husband, Amin, spotted me as I was about to leave the factory. Though it was late in the afternoon, he looked as though he had just woken up. His eyelids, which were normally droopy, gave him the perpetual look of being hungover.
Nishihuan Hujo.
You like to drink, he said. It was a statement, a proposal. I had been coming to the factory for a while now, and Amin had determined that it was time for us to go out and get drunk together. Alcohol was an important part of factory life. It was used in part as a bonding mechanism, and in transactions, it generally helped break down facades. It helped players determine whether someone really needed the deal at a given price in order to move things forward. The best, of course, could stick to a story, no matter how blitzed they became. Drinking games in China were a tournament in which only the most able-bodied drinkers survived. You had to understand that when you were working with a successful factory owner, you were quite likely pitting yourself against an accomplished drunk. And because these drinking outings often involved karaoke, the sort where hostesses were involved, you could also be assured that you were dealing with a serious philanderer as well.
Nishihuan karaoke.
You like karaoke. It was another declaration, a hint of where we were heading that night. Most of the 4- and 5-star hotels in the area had a karaoke bar, the sort where you rented a room with a sofa and a widescreen television, and sexily dressed women were offered as singing companions and paid escorts. We met two of Amin's friends, cohorts, who were also in manufacturing, diehard locals who also spoke almost exclusively in the local dialect, and the lounge that Amin determined we would drink in was the one in my own hotel. As soon as we were seated in our private room, more than a dozen girls were delivered in a lineup as if they were in a beauty contest. These were girls who would be paid by the hour. Their job was to pour drinks and sing songs. Not all of the women who worked in such a place would go home with a customer, though it was the general idea. The government occasionally cracked down on pornography, and they had outlawed government officials from taking mistresses, but this one ritual was left untouched. Naturally, because it was an activity for men only, Sister had been left out, and I could only wonder whether she knew anything about this outing at all. Amin was flirting with the girl he had chosen, and I thought back to one of the first times I had ever been to karaoke. It was years ago, and the group of businessmen were mostly from Taiwan. One of the men was making overtures to the girl sitting next to him, and she resisted. She pointed to the gold band on the man's finger. "You're married," she said, in a protesting way. "Who's married?" "You are," she said. She then pointed to the ring on his finger. "Who, this guy?" he said, lifting the finger that had the ring on it. "Yes, he's married," he said. Then he raised and wiggled his other fingers, one at a time. "But he's not married, and he's not married, and he's not." The girl giggled and slapped him on the shoulder, telling him that he was naughty. Everything about karaoke was a charade, actually. The men grabbed microphones and pretended to be pop stars. They belted out tunes while their rent-a-dates clung to them and clapped enthusiastically when they were done. The room itself was a put-on, made to appear as though it were a living room in someone's home. Much of what went on in these places was about getting sex, but then the men went to so much effort at appearing to court the girls, and the hostesses did their part by appearing to be reluctant. This version of karaoke was especially artificial, and when you found yourself in such a circumstance, the only thing left to do was pretend that you were having a good time. Noticing that I was not making much of an effort to chat up my girl, Amin asked if I was all right. I told him that I was, and then I grabbed my glass and toasted him, and the little get-together that he had arranged. It was easy to think of manufacturing as a dry science, but interpersonal relationships also played a large part. There were foreigners who, in similar circumstances, would have been glad to take a karaoke escort home, for the sake of the business, naturally. Dealing with factory owners, though, I came to understand that going along to get along was not always the best move. On another project, I remembered how one manufacturer offered everyone at the initial meeting a cigarette. The importer I was working with accepted the offer of a cigarette, along with a light, while I took a pass. As we discussed possibilities for cooperation, I noticed that the importer was fumbling with his cigarette. He tapped at the ashtray frequently and at one point had a coughing fit. Eventually, I asked him whether he actually smoked. "I do now," he said. It was his first time doing business in China and he was excited. Things were going well and he seemed rather proud about having sacrificed his lungs for the sake of the deal. This was the sort of thing that factory owners liked to see, actually. They wanted their foreign guests engaging in activities that they would normally not, smoking, drinking heavily, eating foods that they knew their guests would find strange, like insects and the internal organs of farm animals. It was all part of the acculturation process. It was a way of bringing the other side onto their own turf. If the factory owner could get a non-smoker to pick up a nasty habit so easily, just imagine what kind of terms the importer would agree to when it came time to consider the manufacturing contract. It was a good idea to come and have a few drinks, but I felt that I had stayed too long. Amin was drunk and had begun pawing at his girl. When he disappeared into her lap, I took it as my cue to sneak away. Stepping past him, I realized why his head was down. He had vomited on the carpet. One of the advantages of leaving a karaoke lounge early is not waking up with a hangover. When I walked out of the hotel the next morning, I was clear-headed and ready to deal with more issues at the factory. On my way to flagging a taxi, I saw a car in the parking lot that I recognized. It was the four-door Honda that we had all arrived in the previous night. There was no mistaking the vehicle. I recognized the license plate number, and there was a familiar toy in the rear window. Amin had probably crashed at the hotel and taken a room with a karaoke hostess for company. At the factory, Sister cornered me. "How was last night?" she asked. "Last night?" So, she knew that we had been out. She might have also known that her husband never returned home. "Yes, last night. Did you have a good time?" "It was all right." Sister smiled and waited for me to fill the silence with details. She didn't mention karaoke or sexy hostess girls. She tried to appear innocent, but it only made it seem that she was fishing. "Who was there with you?" she asked. She didn't know who was there. "There were a few people," I said. She smiled again, and this time the silence was more awkward. She was hopeful that I might spill the beans, and I thought, if she was a jealous wife, she didn't look the part. Maybe she was looking for something, however small, to hold against her husband. It looked as though I were in a position to do her a favor, and favors were meant to be returned. Getting on Sister's good side might hold some value, I thought. We did have a lot of things that needed to get done at the factory, and there had been so much resistance. It was a close call. In the end, my better sense told me not to get involved. Usually Sister was the one who played thick, and now it was my turn. I told her that I hadn't stayed for very long. This was true, and showing up at the factory early gave me added credibility. Sister dropped the subject, but she brooded. Whether she held it against me that I wouldn't talk, I never knew. But things certainly didn't get any easier at King Chemical.